Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Australian Natalie Worsley. Natalie coordinates the Beyond Nuclear Initiative based at the Arid Lands Environment Centre in the Northern Territory of Australia. She has travelled extensively over the last 10 years, meeting with communities in Australia and overseas who have been impacted by every stage of the nuclear chain, from uranium exploration and mining through to nuclear weapons. The current focus of the Beyond Nuclear Initiative project is working with Aboriginal traditional owners opposed to the federal government plan to force a radioactive waste dump on their traditional country. Natalie Worsley, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you very much, Helen.
Now, Natalie, how old are you now, Natalie?
I just turned 31.
Yeah. How did you get involved in this whole sort of nuclear issue, Natalie?
I've always been involved in different sorts of community and environmental activism. And I think I started with nuclear campaigning after being involved in a play around Palm Sunday, and for that play I had to research the nuclear industry.
Yeah.
From there I was involved in a theatre production called Atomic Oz, which travelled around Australia telling the history of the nuclear industry in Australia.
How old were you then?
I would have been maybe 19 or 20 then.
Yeah, so you sort of became dedicated from that point on, did you?
Well, that's right. During those travels, I was really fortunate to meet and spend time with Aboriginal elders in the desert who had experienced firsthand the impact of nuclear weapons tests and currently operating uranium mines on their projects. And I really began to understand the human impact and the social impact of the nuclear industry. And so from then on, all the work I did reminded me of those elders and made me want to work to support their communities.
Oh, that's wonderful, Nat. So why don't you explain to the audience, who are mostly going to be Americans and actually Canadians, tell us about what happened with the nuclear testing in Australia, the above-ground nuclear testing. Who did it, why, and where did they do it?
Well, during the 1950s and 1960s, there was a series of nuclear bomb tests in the Australian desert, in the South Australian desert. This was conducted as a joint project between the British government and the Australian government, but the weapons being tested were the British government's weapons.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, there was very limited understanding of the Aboriginal people's connection to that area and, in fact, how many people were living in the area. So the notification was very scarce. In fact, one way they used to notify people was dropping leaflets written in English from aeroplanes in the area. But of course, many people at the time didn't read English and didn't understand what those leaflets and also the basic signs that were erected actually referred to.
So they were Indigenous people with their own culture and their own language, and there are many Aboriginal languages actually. And they were nomads, right? And so therefore, how could there have been a census of the number of people and their locations on the land that would be affected?
Well, that's right. And there were some patrols that were done with people driving around looking for communities in the region, but quite often the Aboriginal people would hide from those vehicles because they hadn't had contact with Europeans before and hadn't seen vehicles before like that. So they were quite scared. And one problem was there were fences put up around the prohibited area, and because people weren't aware of these fences being put up, they'd planned their journey between two different water holes. So without carrying much gear, they'd just be walking from one water place to another water place. They'd get halfway or just over halfway and find a fence in the middle, realise they didn't have enough water to make it back again to the start, and many people would just have to sit down and perish at those fences.
Oh, dear. Were they so high that they couldn't be climbed?
I'm not sure exactly, but I know that there are stories of people having been found just sitting along the fences. I think the effort and just the trauma of finding this foreign object across the landscape would have been quite...
Oh, dear. And so when did the British start testing, and how many actual atomic and, I suppose, hydrogen bombs did they blow up?
Well, it was in the early 1950s, and some of the bombs that were tested were actually 50 to 60 times larger than the Hiroshima bomb. So they were quite substantial weapons. There's still a very large area in Australia called the Woomera Prohibited Area, which is uninhabitable and fenced off. And actually, there's a road that runs through it, but you're not allowed to deviate from that road. There's still quite a lot of contamination, in particular from what they called, quite incorrectly, the minor trials, because many of those minor trials involved plutonium. So that's left a very ongoing radioactive legacy on that area.
Plutonium being one of the most dangerous elements that we know, such that a millionth of a gram can cause cancer, and its half-life is 24,400 years. So I wonder how many of the Aboriginal people from that area understand that very fact, Nat.
Well, I'm sure at the time people hadn't had exposure to plutonium before, so there's actually stories as well of families being found camped in the bomb craters after the bombs had been let off, and people still eating wildlife from the area because they weren't to have known that that had been contaminated.
And, yeah, so how many bombs did they actually explode?
I'm not sure of the exact number, but it was over a decade and a half. So it was a very long time of testing, and in particular the minor trials were not very well recorded, though there were hundreds and hundreds of minor trials.
The plutonium ones, they just were a sort of nugget of plutonium, and it was blown up by conventional explosives, and it just scattered the plutonium far and wide, didn't it?
They did various tests. For example, they'd simulate an aeroplane crashing, so they'd build a tower and then drop the weapon from the tower to try and simulate what would happen if that had crashed into the ground. So there's a number of different tests and some quite detailed books that have been written about the tests by nuclear veterans.
Yes. So why did the Australian government let the British come here and contaminate this huge area with radioactive fallout, Natalie?
I think it's two-faced. Firstly, for the Australian government, there was a bit of that mentality of people don't live there, it's an empty space and we may as well sell it off, I guess, and improve our relationship with the British government. What we actually got from having those tests occur was the nuclear reactor that was put at Lucas Heights, which is just out of Sydney, the biggest city in Australia.
Uh-huh.
So what we got was a legacy of contamination in the desert and a nuclear research reactor near our biggest city.
Yes, and I also believe from my reading, Natalie, that there were many scientists in Australia who were very keen to develop the Australian bomb per se, and America was watching them closely, but they thought if they worked with the British, then the British would give them the secrets and help them make a bomb. However, I think in 1972, when, the Non-Proliferation Treaty was signed or another treaty, President Johnson stepped in and said that Australia was not to have a bomb. And since that time, I know there are scientists who still would like one, but that notion has been squashed. Did you know about that, Natalie?
Yes, there were definitely nuclear weapons aspirations from successive governments. And in fact, many people speculate that the government keeps the nuclear research reactor operating just so there is that technology on hand if sometime in the future a government decides again to pursue nuclear weapons.
Yeah. So we only have one, well, we have two little research reactors near Sydney, but we don't have any nuclear power in Australia, right, Natalie?
That's right. And the old reactor that was given to us by the British government has just been closed down. That's waiting to be properly decommissioned when it's cooled down. And the second reactor that's built on the same site is now up and running. It's called the Opal reactor.
Built by the Argentinians.
That's right, by a company called InVap.
And it has a lot of problems and faults, and it's continually closed down. When they first built the Lucas Heights original reactor, it was really out in the countryside. But now, as the population has exploded in Sydney, it's surrounded by 15 schools and kindergartens, and it's a very dirty operation. And a lot of radioactive iodine and other such carcinogenic materials have been expelled from that reactor over years and years, right, Natalie?
That's right. There are ongoing routine releases from the reactor as part of its operating. And while it has been closed down for quite a lot of its lifetime, there is strong concern from the local community about the effect of living and, as you say, having primary schools located so close to the reactor.
Yeah, as children are so sensitive to radiation and getting cancer. So tell us what research has been done, Natalie Worsley, on the effects of the fallout from the British bombs upon the Aboriginal populations in South Australia, who were essentially nomads wandering the desert.
Unfortunately, there's been very limited research done on the effects of those tests on the Aboriginal communities and also on the nuclear veterans, the thousands of servicemen from both the UK and Australia who were involved in the tests, both the major and the minor trials. There's definitely evidence of ongoing and intergenerational health impacts from those tests. That's direct testimony from Aboriginal traditional owners of the area who saw the black cloud coming over, who immediately experienced skin problems. Many people had eye problems. There's stories of people who were blinded very soon after the tests occurred. So there's definitely anecdotal evidence and health impacts that have been documented, but it's very hard to directly associate those, or the medical community's very hesitant to directly associate those with exposure to the bomb test.
So why do you think that the government, the Australian government, did not do an epidemiological study of these people, Natalie?
There's still a big denial in Australia about the process of colonisation and dispossession that happened. As people would know, when the country here was taken over, it was declared to be terra nullius, in that no one was seen to be living here. And in fact, up until extremely recently in the 60s, Aboriginal people were actually still classified as flora and fauna.
Oh, were they? I had no idea about that.
So people weren't actually granted citizenship or actually status as humans until the 60s, which is, you know, very close to the current time frame. So it sort of shows the ongoing mentality of the government to relationships with Aboriginal people.
Yes, and the British settlers used to poison the Aboriginal water holes and force them off cliffs. They did dreadful, dreadful things and massacred them, right?
All around Australia there were massacres, and some of them have been documented and some of them have actually been recorded through oral history. And people living today that I work with throughout the Northern Territory and South Australia have stories that have been passed down over the generations of those massacres having occurred to their families.
Oh dear. No wonder you got so involved. I lived in Adelaide. I came to Adelaide, which is south of the test site in South Australia. It's the capital of South Australia. I invite you all to go and look at your atlases and look up Australia so that you can identify what places we're discussing. But I moved to Adelaide just before the British blew up a huge bomb in 1954. And we got a huge fallout in Adelaide. Now, how did I know? Well, there was a man, a scientist, testing the thyroids of sheep in Adelaide, and he found that they had, after that test, a huge amount of radioactive iodine in their thyroid glands. No one tested humans. No one told the Adelaide population, including me, as an early medical student, not to drink the milk, eat the food, or to be wary. And I must say, I saw as I graduated from medicine and practiced at the Royal Adelaide Hospital quite a number of young people dying of thyroid cancer. But that too has never been acknowledged, really, has it, Natalie?
That's right. And the fallout from many of these tests not only went south to Adelaide, but was recorded as far away as a place called Lismore, which is in northeastern New South Wales. So that's right over on the eastern coast of Australia. In fact, the wind carried the radioactive particles all the way across the country. So there's definitely been contamination from those tests felt all across Australia.
Yes, rather like the tests in Nevada in the United States, where, oh, I think the National Cancer Institute estimated, oh, I can't remember the exact number, but tens of thousands of people who developed thyroid cancer right across the nation, including the northern part of New York State, because of those tests. And they were only looking at you know, thyroid cancer, not the many other cancers that are caused by other fission products released from the bombs. So let's then, Natalie Worsley, move on to uranium mining, because we have 40% of the world's richest uranium in Australia. And in fact, that uranium was used to make the British bombs, was it not?
Some uranium was used, yes.
Yeah. So what? Will you paint a picture now of what is happening in Australia, the uranium mines that are currently opened? British bombs, was it not?
Some uranium was used, yes.
Yeah. So what? Will you paint a picture now of what is happening in Australia, the uranium mines that are currently opened, on whose land they exist, how the Aboriginal elders were inveigled into allowing these huge companies, Rio Tinto and BHP Billiton, to take over their land and dig up the uranium. Can you just paint a fairly large picture of what's happening in this country? And as I talk, I want people to understand that the area of Australia is the same as the area of the United States. In other words, it is a vast, vast country, mostly desert.
Well, over the years, there's been different uranium mines open and closed, and some of these have never been properly rehabilitated. In fact, I'd say all of the ones that have been closed have not been properly rehabilitated. In particular, there's a disastrous project in the north called Rum Jungle, and I've been told before that some uranium from Rum Jungle was actually used for the nuclear test that happened in the South Australian desert. And there were kilometres and kilometres of a beautiful river system called the Finniss River that were contaminated through that mining operation. And in fact, this was back in the 50s, this was operating. Now the government is still budgeting in the federal budget for rehabilitation for that site, because it's been disaster after disaster in attempting to clean that up.
What sort of disasters?
Just ongoing contamination, never a thorough rehabilitation in terms of actually containing the contaminated materials, stopping them from entering the watercourses.
Yeah, and I don't think the miners from Rum Jungle were ever followed up either to see what diseases they developed over their lifetime, were they, Nat?
No, well, Australia still doesn't have a national register for uranium workers. So we have the situation where we currently have three operating uranium mines. There's Olympic Dam Uranium Mine on Kookatha Country, which takes water from Arabunna Country. Those are different.
Well, wait a minute. Who are the Kookathas and the Arabunnas?
They're different Aboriginal groups from the area.
Yes.
And many of those people were, in fact, directly affected by the nuclear bomb tests.
Yeah.
So there's senior Kookatha women who the country is fenced off by the Olympic Dam Uranium Mine, who were suffering by having been moved from their community, but also affected by the fallout from those nuclear bomb tests. So that's the largest uranium deposit in Australia at the Olympic Dam mine. Currently, there's a proposal for an expansion of that mine to become the largest uranium mine in the world. And the company likes to boast that that would be an open pit mine so big you'd be able to see it from space. A 3 by 3 kilometre size pit, which is about 1 kilometre deep. So it's quite an appalling size mine, I think, and will be using vast, vast quantities of water in the driest state, in the driest continent in the world. So at current, the mine uses 30 to 40 million litres of water a day. After the expansion, they're looking to use in excess of 200 million litres of water a day.
And where do they get this water from, Natalie?
The water's currently being taken from the Artesian Basin, which is an underground water source, which is covers approximately a third of the Australian continent. So it's a very large water basin, but it's a very ancient water system. And in fact, the water comes down from the north, from the highlands of Papua New Guinea, under the ground and travels extremely slowly. So it's a very ancient water source that's being tapped into. And the Aboriginal people in the area have definitely noticed a drop in the pressure in the water systems in the area. And there's a lot of unique water systems called mound springs in the area, which is in the middle of a desert. All of a sudden, there'll be a fresh water source bubbling up. And people relied on these for living. Moving from place to place. And there's also a lot of species that exist on these particular mound springs that are nowhere else in the world. So they're quite unique ecosystems and very important to protect.
And what's happening to them now? What have the Aboriginal people noticed at the Mound Springs?
The biggest change has been the lowering in the water pressure and lowering in the water level. And with the water not being able to recharge, it's obviously not as clean. And people have very strong cultural connections to that area because water is so precious in the desert. A lot of the traditional stories and cultural connections are related to the water in the area. So it's very stressful for people that, you know, this very precious source has been contaminated and is being affected by a company that's mining such a toxic substance.
A British company too, to boot. Aren't they going to take 70 million tonnes a week from the Olympic Dam mine? Or do I have that figure wrong, Natalie?
I'm not sure what their latest projections are for the expansion. It's a mixed ore mine, so it's not exclusively a uranium mine. It also mines copper and nickel and other substances. So that's one argument, is to say that if the expansion goes ahead, then they should leave the uranium in the ground. And if the company does wish to operate with the other substances, there's no particular argument for taking that uranium and for processing it and taking it off-site. In fact, they could be leaving that uranium where it is and still operating the company at a profit.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to the next uranium mine.
So in the Northern Territory, right up...
Describe what the Northern Territory is, Natalie.
The Northern Territory runs approximately the middle third of the continent, and then if you split that in half, it's the northern half of the middle third of the continent. It's the least populated area. We have 5 states and 2 territories.
In Australia?
In Australia.
Yeah.
It's very low population and very large areas. It's a very high Aboriginal population in the Northern Territory, and a lot of small, remote Aboriginal communities and outstations, as opposed to somewhere like New South Wales, which is the most populated state and has a lot of small towns, but with a lot better services and infrastructure. So quite often in the Northern Territory, there's hundreds of kilometres between service stations when you're travelling as well.
And most Aborigines now have adjusted to the white man's life, i.e. eating processed food, white bread, sugar, drinking a lot of alcohol in many areas. They don't eat what they call bush tucker too much. They used to, of course, wander stark naked and collect wonderful bush tucker, which was full of vitamins. They used to kill a kangaroo with a boomerang and catch a lot of fish, and they were very healthy. But now they've been inveigled into living our lifestyle, and they have a hugely high incidence of diabetes, of heart disease, of hypertension, and they actually have one of the highest infant mortalities in the world, anywhere, I think.
That's right. There are a lot of health issues, in particular diabetes, and a lot of that is to do with people's changed diets, but also access to health services. And the government has not made an effort to make sure that health services in remote regions in Aboriginal communities are up to the standard of what you'd expect in other areas that aren't predominantly Aboriginal communities. It's actually a bit of a misnomer that a lot of Aboriginal people do drink alcohol. In fact, the statistics are very low.
Oh, are they?
It's low for the number of people, Aboriginal people, drinking alcohol.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, due to social factors, people tend to binge drink and drink more alcohol in one sitting. And one reason people do that is because of the huge pressure for people and the huge the difference in actual laws that apply to Aboriginal people being able to access alcohol. For example, in the Northern Territory, the government brought in what they called an emergency response intervention 3 years ago. And as part of that, Northern Territory Aboriginal communities to be what they call prescribed areas and to be dry communities, so no alcohol is allowed in those areas. They failed to mention that actually a lot of those communities were already designated dry areas, and that had been a community-driven initiative. But what happened is the government came in, put the boot down, and said, we declare all of these areas dry areas. If you're caught drinking, then you'll get a massive fine. So what we see is people travelling, buying, say, a carton of alcohol, and then having to consume that whole carton before they arrive back at the boundary of their community.
Oh, gosh. And then there are the glue sniffers and petrol sniffers too.
Which has actually decreased a lot over the last decade due to community-driven...
Good. Good.
So there's a lot of senior men and women who've worked very hard to stamp out what at one stage was becoming an epidemic of petrol sniffing.
Amongst the children and the adolescents, the young people.
Right. And of course, one of the main factors that leads to drug and alcohol dependency across the board, not just in Aboriginal communities, is poverty. There's an absolute extreme epidemic of poverty. In fact, in many communities, we see 15 or 20 people living in each household. And this is something that the government has paid lip service to trying to correct. They've put hundreds of millions of dollars into so-called housing projects to build houses in remote areas, but they have failed to deliver on this. And in fact, you can count on two hands the number of houses that have been built for a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars.
Oh,
it's been shaved off by layer after layer of bureaucracy.
White bureaucrats.
Absolutely.
The other thing is, and I think it's important for our American and Canadian listeners to know, is that if you look at Australia really with open eyes, we do actually have, to a large degree, an apartheid system. Would you agree with that, Natalie?
The Northern Territory intervention is apartheid law. It's racist law, and in fact, for that to be brought in, the government had to suspend the Racial Discrimination Act from operating.
And what is that?
The Racial Discrimination Act was brought in the mid-70s to Australia to say that any legislation that's made cannot be done to the detriment of one particular group of people in society. And they have what they call a special measure, where they say that discrimination can be made in a positive way if it benefits a particular community.
So give us an example of how that's not used well.
Well, the fact that they had to suspend the racial discrimination
for
the intervention to go ahead shows that it's blatantly racist policy, because it only originally applied to Aboriginal people living in certain geographic regions. It had nothing to do with those people's financial abilities. It had nothing to do with their employment. All it did was pick 73 communities in the Northern Territory who had more than 100 people living in them and declare them to be prescribed areas, and put a series of blanket measures across all of those communities. Basically, people say, tar everyone with the same brush.
So why do you think they did it?
Well, there's many reasons why the intervention was brought in. At the time, it was coming up to a federal election, and though it's cynical, I think it's fair enough to say that the government at the time was hoping to get some votes from looking to be taking tough action on what they'd really overblown into being an epidemic of child abuse. And while there is child abuse in some remote areas, there's child abuse in every main city and in every suburb as well. But really, the former Howard government was using a report that had been written, which was community-driven, and asking for different programs. They'd use that as an election ploy, as we saw previously with the Howard government using an episode of a refugee boat called the Tampa to basically try and win itself some votes before the election.
So do you think also the federal government took over this Aboriginal tribal land was there uranium and were there minerals on much of that land, Natalie Worsley?
I'd say all of Australia's minerals lie underneath Aboriginal land.
Yeah.
This entire continent is Aboriginal land that was never ceded. Sovereignty over the land was never ceded. There is a correlation between the areas in the Northern Territory that were taken over as prescribed areas and areas of mineral exploration, but actually almost the entire country is covered with exploration applications.
Oh, God almighty. Well, let's talk about the uranium mine in the Northern Territory. What is it called? How big is it? In what area is it? And what is actually happening about the health consequences of that mine, Natalie Worsley?
Well, the mine in the Northern Territory is called the Ranger Uranium Mine. This has been operating since the 70s, I believe, and is now owned by Energy Resources Australia, ERA. It's actually located right in the middle of an area called Kakadu National Park. And Kakadu is a World Heritage listed area. Absolutely beautiful country. Absolutely beautiful country. Very lush, tropical, not only beautiful environmental heritage, but very strong cultural heritage. And that there's Aboriginal rock art dating back tens of thousands of years and possibly longer that can be found in this area. So it's listed for cultural and environmental values as a World Heritage Area. So smack bang in the middle of that national park, they've excised an area, which is the Ranger Uranium Mine lease. And there is uranium in other areas of the park, but the traditional owners in those areas have been very strong in recent decades of saying no to the companies looking and actually working hard now to reincorporate those areas, which are still mineral leases, to put them back into the national park. Unfortunately, with Ranger, it was a process whereby people were just worn down over years and years of companies coming, what we call humbugging, just really persistently
feeding them with beer.
Yes, pestering people, offering people new cars, all sorts of classic tactics, divide and conquer the community, basically to get the mine project to go ahead. And in the end, some of the elders were just so worn down by the process that they signed on the mine. But, you know, there's still the younger generation coming up are very opposed to the mine. And in recent weeks have actually been speaking out very strongly because there's an ongoing problem with contamination and leakages from the mine.
Well, tell us what the problem is, Nat.
Well, one of the tailings dams at the Ranger mine has actually found to be leaking 100,000 litres of radioactive material every day. Now, with the Ranger mine being in the Kakadu National Park, They say that it's the most closely monitored uranium mine in Australia, if not the world. Yet they can't seem to stop 100,000 litres leaking every day, which is quite extraordinary.
And where does it leak?
Well, according to the company, it's just going straight down out of the tailings area. But, I mean, obviously water travels sideways.
Mm-hmm.
So traditional owners are concerned that water, the contaminated water and materials, are actually travelling outside of the fenced area of the mine.
Of course. And getting into the Magella Creek and other areas where the Aboriginal people fish. And, of course, the uranium and the radioactive waste coming from a uranium mine contains many things such as radium that concentrates in fish and causes bone cancer and leukemia, and it gave Madame Curie leukemia. Uranium itself causes bone cancer and other things. It lasts for, well, its half-life is 4.5 billion years. So those people, if they're still eating bush tucker, will be eating radioactive food, right?
That's right. And there has been increased levels of radioactive materials found in the creeks downstream. Your name's Magella Creek, but also other creeks. And the company's at a loss to actually explain how these increases.
Oh, fancy that. I mean, how could they? Aren't they awful? I mean, I remember I was taken around in a bus by ERA, who owns the Ranger Uranium Mine. There was only me. I was not allowed to go with any other tourists. And there were about, I don't know, three or four health physicists, giving me the guff on, you know, how clean it was and the whole thing. And I said to them, what happens to the uranium once it's exported? They said, oh, we take no responsibility for that at all. Like, you know, we're heroin pushers, but we don't care where it goes sort of stuff.
Yeah, they consider that to be a government problem. And
likes
to say that it has safeguard agreements with particular countries.
Yeah, now let's talk about what's the other uranium mine. There are three operating mines so far in Australia, Natalie Worsley.
Mm-hmm.
Just to say, Natalie coordinates the Beyond Nuclear Initiative based at the Yarrad Lands Environment Centre in the Northern Territory of Australia. So let's do the third uranium mine.
Sure. Just one more quick note on Ranger, just another note. In fact, you mentioned health before, and there's also a strong concern with worker health. In 2004, there was an incident where someone plugged in the wrong pipe as part of the operation, and workers were actually showering and drinking in water that was up to four times their allowable limits of exposure to uranium. So that's had quite a devastating effect on the workers who were involved in that accident. And I believe many have left due to stress. So once again, for a very heavily monitored or so-called heavily monitored mine, there's ongoing issues of worker safety as well as for the local
Aboriginal. Yes, and also the workers are exposed to radon gas as they mine, which can cause lung cancer, and to whole body radiation, which can mutate genes in their sperm and their testicles to damage future generations and their children. So they're at risk and swallowing the dust, and it's very dusty up there because it's very hot and dry. And the dust contains radium, which also goes to bone and causes bone cancer and leukemia. And interestingly, the Electrical Trades Union in Australia has recently made a film called When the Dust Settles, which you can find actually on YouTube. It's wonderful. About the risks to uranium miners, and the Electrical Trades Union has banned their workers from working in the uranium mines, both in Queensland and the Northern Territory, but soon that will be a national policy of the Electrical Trades Union. And you know, you can't really run uranium mines without having electricity and having electricians working out things, right?
Yes, that's a very bold move by the union, one that should definitely be commended, because the union has recognised the risk that the industry poses to the health of their workers, and they're saying they would like to represent those workers, but they're doing so by helping them find jobs in other industries that aren't as damaging to their health. And we were just talking before about ongoing health impacts, that Australia still doesn't have a national register for its workers. So what the situation at the moment...
For its nuclear workers.
For nuclear workers. Yeah. So someone working at the Olympic Dam mine could reach their maximum exposure limit for the year, leave that job, travel to the Ranger mine, again reach their maximum exposure level, then leave that and travel to the third mine we'll discuss soon, the Beverley mine. And there's no ongoing monitoring from either the government or the particular companies to say those workers can't be jumping around from mine to mine and actually in the end being exposed to more than their allowable limit because they're moving between companies.
And, yeah, and they're only measuring the gamma radiation with those monitors they wear on their belts. The amount of radon that they inhale is never measured, nor is the amount of radium that they ingest through the dust measured. So it's a very partial measurement of the radiation they receive, right?
Yes, and again, I think it is important that there is a national register. That would hopefully allow for some ongoing monitoring for these workers many decades into the future and also for their families.
Do you think there's a national register nationally in the United States for uranium miners? I know that there was for plutonium workers, but in the labs, but I'm not sure about uranium miners.
I'm not sure about that, and I've recently seen a film called Poison Wind, which follows, in particular, Native American workers in uranium mines in the 50s, and as part of that film, there's discussion about compensation for workers in uranium mines, and there's a clause, though, apparently, in that compensation for post-71 workers, whereby the government's saying that after 1971 or so, the industry standards increased, so people weren't exposed to such dangerous working conditions.
Oh dear.
So the compensation's not extended to those families. So there's a big struggle going on for people up to current day workers in uranium mines to have the same level of government support.
And many of the workers are Navajo Indians and Indigenous people as well.
That's right. And people at the time, many thought they were supporting the United States in their war effort and were actually doing something for the benefit of the country without having the full dangers of the industry and their working conditions explained.
Yes. So let's move now to the third uranium mine in Australia called the Honeymoon Mine. Who owns it and what is that all about and where is it, Natalie?
Well, Honeymoon's actually not producing yet. It's been through most of its regulatory processes, but it's been a long protracted 20 years or so of Honeymoon actually trying to come online. The third operating mine is the Beverley Mine.
Ah, right.
Adnamutna country.
Well, and the Adnamutnas, that's another tribe of Aboriginal people.
That's right, and they're located around the Flinders Range in South Australia.
Yeah.
It's, again, very beautiful country, very mountainous, big eucalyptus trees, lovely gorges and rivers, so very beautiful country in that area, but stretching into the desert too. And that's owned by Heathgate Resources. And Beverley is the only uranium...
And Heathgate, wait a minute, is Canadian, right?
Canadian company.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the only uranium mine in Australia operating by what we call in situ leach mining. The other two are underground, currently underground mines. Of course, Olympic Dam, they want to make open pit. So Beverley is an acid in situ leach mine, and I think Australia might be the only country of sort of comparable economic situation in the world that actually allows in situ acid leach mining to go ahead. Most countries recognise that it's an extremely damaging process for the environment and they don't let that process actually happen. And
including the US and Canada. So what does it actually mean? What sort of acid do they use, and what are they doing by injecting this acid into the ground?
So it's a sulfuric acid type substance.
Concentrated sulfuric acid?
They use what they call injection and extraction wells, where they pump the sulfuric acid solution down into the underground aquifer, the water body, and then they suck it up through an extraction well. And the acid is actually used to separate the uranium from the other parts of the rock.
It dissolves the uranium in the rock.
That's right. And so they can extract that solution. But then once that's done and they have a lot of the waste concentrate still in the liquid form, what the company does is they simply pump that back underground.
They don't. The acid and the radioactive acid back into the Great Artesian Basin?
It's well, the company at the time when they started the operation said that the aquifer that the Beverly Mine sits over, the Beverly deposit, is actually a discrete aquifer that does not have connection to other water bodies in the region.
But they have no idea.
No, and of course water moves underground. Of course over the years different fissures and cracks appear in rocks. And of course by changing the water pressure and water levels, there's drawdown effects in different areas. And so water has definitely moved around the region. And of course, how did the water get there in the first place? It travelled underground. So people, traditional owners in the area, have never quite believed that. And in fact, the company's argument, and backed up by the government, is that the aquifers in that area are not fit for human consumption. And so they think it's actually acceptable. And by law, the company can pump that solution back down into the aquifer with absolutely no requirement to rehabilitate that aquifer.
And those aquifers are used by the Aboriginal people to drink from. They're used by native wildlife, wallabies, kangaroos, snakes, you name it, and also by the stations, which are huge cattle stations out in that area, where the cattle drink and the station managers and their families and their workers also drink from that water, right?
That's right. The water in those aquifers sustains life in the desert.
Right. So this is really, I have to say, obscene. Okay. So now the next thing I want to get to, Natalie Worsley, is the radioactive waste dump. What you need to explain to the listeners in Canada and America is how much radioactive waste Australia actually has, where they want to dump this waste, and then we'll get onto the railway line and other such things.
So Australia doesn't actually have nuclear power. What we have is one nuclear research reactor, which is a fairly small reactor, as well as that, and that's been producing waste through the 50 odd years of its operating life. As well as that, we have stockpiles of waste around the country from, for example, contaminated soil from the nuclear bomb test that happened in the South Australian desert.
Yeah.
And then ongoing small amounts of waste that is accumulated from hospitals and universities and different research projects.
Yep.
So the proposal at the moment is for a low and what we call long-lived intermediate level waste dump in the Northern Territory. And just to backtrack a little bit, there was been a 10-year plan for actually a waste dump to be in South Australia on the same area for the Kookatha people where, as we said, they had both the nuclear bomb test and now have a uranium mine operating.
Oh, that's a good idea. So they're kind of a triplicate danger to their existence.
Yes. So when that was proposed, a group of senior Aboriginal cultural women formed a committee called the Super Pedi Kunga Juda, a council of senior Aboriginal women, came together and said very firmly what they say in their language, irriti wanti, the poison, leave it. We don't want this waste dump on our country. We've experienced this industry. We know this industry. And they fought a 10-year battle against the federal government to stop that waste dump, and they won. They gathered community support from all around the country, and even their South Australian state government came in and backed them up in the end. And it's a very good news story where a small council of women managed to defeat a federal government proposal for a national radioactive waste dump.
Wonderful. Okay, so now what are the new moves for a national waste dump?
Well, after that plan was defeated, the federal government scratched its head and thought, we lost against the South Australian government, that's a state, because they managed to legislate against the federal government. Now, in the Northern Territory, it's actually still considered to be under the jurisdiction of the federal government. It's a territory, not a state, so we don't have the same legal powers.
Doesn't have autonomy.
That's right. And so the federal government thought straight away, we'll look to the Northern Territory. The only other territory is the Australian Capital Territory, which has Parliament House, similar to Washington, D.C., and they weren't so keen to have a radioactive waste dump right near Parliament House, so they looked to the territory.
Maybe that would be a good place to have it.
Well, many people say if the waste was in the backyard of the government, they might be a little bit more responsible with how...
A little bit more, yeah. Yeah, go on.
So straight away they picked three sites that were technically owned by the Commonwealth. They were Commonwealth Department of Defence sites. They named those sites and said, one of these three, the best of the bunch, that's going to be a national radioactive waste dump, just for waste produced by federal agencies. Now, this was before they'd done any scientific studies at all of these particular areas. And in fact, there was a national site selection study done, started in the 80s. None of these sites were shortlisted, even in the top 10 of preferred sites, if you're looking around the country. So it really showed that it was politics before science, that they were looking for an expedient solution, out of sight, out of mind, and similar to the nuclear bomb test mentality, low population, large Aboriginal population, they thought it wouldn't matter if they forced a dump on the territory because they wouldn't lose many votes. But what they weren't expecting was, again, a very, very strong community resistance and community campaign against this facility.
And you've been working with the Aboriginal people, haven't you, Natalie? I've really admired the work that you've been doing about this waste dump on their land.
Thank you, Helen. Yes, I've been based in Alice Springs, which is right in the heart of Australia. It's about 500 kilometres from Uluru, from Ayers Rock, right in the middle of the country. And I've been based here working firstly with those three communities that were originally targeted, and then another community at a place called Muckaty, which is now the only community that's being targeted by the current Labor Party government to host the radioactive waste dump. And we worked very hard over the years to get the message out to people to say, the government gets on television and said, oh, it's just low-level waste, hospital gloves, test tubes, things like that. There's nothing to worry about. So the Aboriginal traditional owners have said, if it's so safe, why don't you leave it in Sydney near the population centres? We know that it's not safe because we know the history of this industry. We've done our research and we know that you're just trying to get it, the problem away from the major population centres. So people have stood up very strongly and said, we don't want this facility because the low-level waste would be buried and that would permanently affect that land.
And the aquifer, because it's a high rainfall area in the monsoon season, in the wet season, right?
Muckaty in particular has very high seismic activity.
Seismic, again, yes, it had an earthquake there the other day. Great place to bury radioactive waste.
But again, even though we've come this far in the process, whereby it's the only site currently being assessed for a radioactive waste dump, there still hasn't been an environmental impact assessment or any serious and in-depth scientific study done. The government's whittled away at the sites it was looking at until it found the one it thought it could force it on because it's the most politically expedient, and still hasn't actually done a proper scientific study. So it's quite extraordinary process. It's very back to front. And in fact, the Minister, Martin Ferguson, has said, we're going to choose the site for the radioactive waste dump and then we're going to consult with the community about it. So fairly back to front process.
And didn't the previous government, the Howard government, which was to the Americans the equivalent of the Republican Party, but in fact is called the Liberal government here, didn't they pay two of the tribal elders who really didn't represent the people who owned Muckaty, didn't they pay them a sum of $12 million, Natalie?
The deal that's been offered to the traditional owner group to host the radioactive waste dump at Muckaty is a package of $12 million. There's two things on that. Firstly, just for a small group putting their hand up and saying, we nominate this area, they received a payment of $200,000 just for nominating.
Right.
And many people say that's quite an incentive just to put your hand up and say you can look at our area. There is an issue that the broader traditional owner group, and there's about, well, there's over 400 people who are responsible for that Muckaty Land Trust, and this is a small site within the Land Trust. The the broader traditional owner group has never consented to this process, and many people say they were never consulted about this process. In fact, some of the traditional owners have just last week lodged a federal court case against the government and the Northern Land Council, which is meant to be their Aboriginal representative body, to say that they want the process halted and they never consented to it.
Yeah, and they've got some of the best lawyers in Australia working gratis, pro bono on this, haven't they?
We have a very strong legal team because those lawyers travelled up to Tennant Creek, which is the town close by where many of the traditional owners live, sat down for a couple of days and just couldn't believe the story. And just jumping back to the money, we mentioned the $12 million. This isn't being offered to traditional owners as a cash payment. This is being offered to people in exchange as a package for roads, for housing and for education scholarships. I think it's absolutely appalling in 21st century Australia that people living, Aboriginal people in remote areas, have to consider having a nuclear waste dump to be able to get a house or to be able to get a road or to send their kids to school. It's just extraordinary.
Oh. Okay, so I want to move on to the railway line. There's a railway line that transects Australia from north to south, from Adelaide all the way up through Alice Springs to Darwin. And recently that railway line has, parts of it have been built by a company, an American company, right, Natalie?
That's right. Well, actually, the railway was designed and constructed by a joint venture. 50% of that joint venture was Kellogg Brown and Root, which is a company that's related to Halliburton.
Well, yeah, it's an, it is actually owned by Halliburton, yes. And Dick Cheney ran Halliburton, right?
That's right, yes.
And who was the other corporation that worked with Halliburton on the railway line?
So KBR had a 50%. A company called McMahon Holdings was 10%. Barclay Mowlam was 20%. And John Holland, which is a large construction company, had a 20%.
Right.
As part of the joint venture. But there were other shareholders involved in actually seeing that come to fruition, including both the Northern and Central Aboriginal Land Councils.
Oh, really?
Give permission for the railway to go its particular course by consulting with traditional owners and making sure it avoided particular sacred sites.
So what's your picture of how this railway line is going to be used in the future, Natalie Worsley?
Well, the railway line is currently used as one of the main export avenues for yellowcake, for uranium oxide, from the Olympic Dam uranium mine in South Australia and also from the Ranger uranium mine in the Northern Territory. So we have large amounts of yellowcake being transported up this railway already. And if the expansion of the Olympic Dam uranium mine goes ahead, then every week, communities like where I live in Alice Springs would see, every day would see a 1 kilometre long train.
1 kilometre long.
So people are concerned, firstly, that that's going to be increased. It's heading out through the Port of Darwin, which is the northernmost city in the Northern Territory. And already there's massive problems in Darwin Harbour in terms of infrastructure. We've had spills of radioactive copper concentrate into the harbour. There's very heavy industry currently found to be polluting the harbour. And the traditional owners, the Aboriginal people up there, are called the Larrakia Nation. They're very strongly opposed to the yellowcake being transported out of Darwin Harbour and have said they're also very strongly opposed to radioactive waste being brought back in through that harbour to head to the Northern Territory dump site.
Yes, that would be the waste, the reprocessed waste from our uranium that's been fissioned at Lucas Heights, coming from France, I think, and England. Is that right? And it's high-level waste.
Yes, we have sent some waste to the United States, but that contract allows that waste to stay in the United States.
Okay.
I think that's being, all of the, I guess, usable parts of that have been extracted.
So what do you think the chances are of Australia receiving portions of the radioactive waste from the United States of America, of which they have hundreds of thousands of tonnes?
Well, our current contract directly with the states is that it stays there. In terms of the waste we receive or are due to receive back from France and Scotland, what we get back is the equivalent amount of spent fuel rods, the equivalent amount of waste that we sent there. So it's not the exact same.
Yeah, but what about America's own radioactive waste. Do you think there's a chance and a deal was done by the previous government to possibly bring radioactive waste from America into Australia and dumping it in our desert?
I think there's many countries around the world who are definitely keen for Australia to take international radioactive waste, and that's no secret. People have been knocking on the doors of successive Australian governments. It's talked about at every international nuclear industry conference.
Oh, really?
People would love Australia to open up to international waste. The current government policy is to not allow this, but of course, legislation can change, governments can change, and so sometime in the future, the Aboriginal people have said that's one reason they're strongly opposed to this waste dump being built, because there's nothing to stop it down the track expanding to be an international dump.
And indeed, a previous Prime Minister advocates us becoming an international radioactive waste dump. And there's one last thing that may be hopeful is the Maritime Union, the guys who run the ships and load the ships and stuff, they may, I'm hoping, come out against uranium transportation. Do you think that's a possibility, Natalie?
Well, we've been working very closely with the Maritime Union in terms of the waste dump campaign.
Yes.
And they've met with the Aboriginal traditional owners at two of the ports in Australia and have said very strongly they think it's a blatant human rights abuse how the government's trying to force the radioactive dump on their country and
right.
their community, and that they won't unload the waste, the union members, if it's destined to head to that site. So that is promising for looking to join with what the electrical trade unions have done and said actually the entire industry needs to be banned.
Yeah. Well, look, Natalie, we've come to the end of our time, but I must say this has been an absolutely fascinating interview, one. And two, it shows everyone what a young woman from the age of 19 or 20, and she's now 31, can do almost single-handedly in a country which has huge problems. And Natalie, I congratulate you for the individual work you do with the Aboriginal populations and for the way you've brought the anti-nuclear groups together across the Australian continent.
Thank you very much, Helen. There's a lot of dedicated people working
yes.
on the nuclear-free campaigns in Australia that have sort of mentored me and supported me, and I get a lot of advice and experience from.
It's wonderful. Well, thank you very much, Natalie.
Thank you.
My guest on the show today was Natalie Worsley, coordinator of the Beyond Nuclear Initiative based at the Arid Lands Environment Centre in the Northern Territory of Australia. Thank you for listening today. I hope you learnt a lot about Australia and what it's up to. It's doing a lot of very bad things. If you want to learn more about previous programs or perhaps contribute to this effort, go to our website at ifyoulovethisplanet.org. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.